Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Typically, I hang up as soon as I know it's going to be a sales call, but this one was different. It was from my alma mater, Azusa Pacific University. They were persuading alumni to update their contact information for a networking book. It sounded harmless enough, so I gave the voice on the other end of the line my details. And as she was inputting the data, she told me about how wonderful it was that I was a special education teacher. And in the very same breath, she exclaimed, "Isn't it awful how people are trying to put students with disabilities in the same classrooms as everyone else?" I immediately responded, "Sorry to burst your bubble, ma'am, but I am one of those people." So, why would someone have a problem with students with disabilities being educated side by side with their non-disabled peers? For those of us who are familiar with the decades of research that support inclusive education and who have experienced success with authentic inclusion, it's easy for us to see that it works. For almost everyone else, though, it appears to be a near impossible concept to grasp. So, despite all the research and resources that are available for schools and districts, why are we continuing to fight an outdated mindset over inclusive education? Here is my short answer. The creation of special education services have become synonymous with separate education services. For most of the 20th century, severely disabled family members were institutionalized. Though this has become less acceptable over time, the damage has been done. Just as we had awoken to the realization that people with disabilities deserve an education and a living space, we didn't know how to provide these supports within the context of a broader non-disabled world. So we created separate systems. This wouldn't be so bad if these separate systems had changed to evolve with our culture's attitudes towards civil and disability rights, but that is not the case. Today, we have fragments of pockets of schools and communities that do inclusion well. The vast majority of places, however, are either unwilling to implement inclusive practices or lack the knowledge and resources to know where to start. The long answer to this question of why is what we are devoting the podcast to for our 7th season. But hold on. Isn't special education working, you might ask? Well, it depends on both your expectations and how you define working. The promise of self-contained or segregated special education classrooms and schools do not provide the most benefit for the most children. And this is by no means the fault of the teachers who work in these classrooms. I was one of those teachers, and I'm in the unique position of having taught in a separate classroom for 13 years, and at the same time, promoting inclusive practices. It can be done. Also, there are schools and districts right now that are rejecting the mindset that separate or special is better, and educating a wide variety of learners in the same spaces at the same time. Let me quickly share with you my vision for educating students with a wide range of abilities, and you will hear me talk about this throughout the whole season. Imagine there's no special education, nothing special or separate, one educational system that supports all students. Every teacher gets the same training on intervention strategies as every other teacher. Some states and teacher training centers have already started this dual certification process. And then there's the funding. Instead of special ed funding and general ed funding, there's only education funding. Segregation is over if we want it. Today on the podcast, our first guest of the new season is Lou Brown, co-founder of TASH, an organization that advocates for human rights and inclusion for people with significant disabilities and support needs. He's also the professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin. We discuss what supports for students with significant disabilities look like before 1975 and the progress that we have made since then. My name is Tim Villegas. We are so glad you are here with us. After a short break, our interview with Lou Brown.
Hi, my name is Lou Brown, and you're listening to the Think Inclusive podcast.
One of the things that people may not know about you is your connection to the disability rights movement.
So on January 1965, my wife and I and our infant son, 1 month old son, moved to Western Carolina Center. And my job there was to do diagnostic stuff, which was essentially meaningless. And then I worked on a ward with people who are non-ambulatory, and then on another ward with people who are ambulatory, but they couldn't speak, basically couldn't speak. And the job was to do something. Well, this one particular ward had 40 ambulatory people that were in one big room all day. And said, well, what are you going to do? And so we said, well, we've got to get them out of this room. We've got to break them up. Okay. So I learned a very important lesson. We must increase the number of environments in which people with disabilities function. We must. The fewer environments, the more problems they have than everybody else has. The second thing is, they can't be with each other. You have to heterogeneously group. The whole field was based on homogeneous grouping. Schools for this, schools for that, classes for this, class for that. And I said, you know, we realized that you can't put three kids with autism in one place. You can't put 10 kids with severe physical disabilities in one place. It's just homogeneous grouping had to go. So then I went for a doctoral program at Florida State with Jim Sposhi and Ben Allen. And I worked at the Sunland Training Centers around Florida for 3 years. And it was the same thing. What I did and tried to do at Sunland is the same thing I tried to do at Western Carolina Center. You take people, do we have to increase the number of environments in which they're functioning? And then we had to try to teach them something. So in 1969, I moved to my wife and I, and our young son moved to Madison, to the University of Wisconsin. And I remember driving up and we're talking about, now what are we going to do? She couldn't find Wisconsin on the map. I had never been there. I heard much about it except the interview. And so I said, now what are we going to do there? So I remember saying, well, we're just going to have to get out of the institution business. We're just going to have to close them down, make sure nobody has to go there because they're just no good for people with disabilities. And the second thing is, of course, the people we worked with at the institutions were considered too disabled to attend the institution school. So we set up teaching programs for them in bathrooms and hallways and closets. We just got to get them in school. So they all have to go to school. So that, if you think about that, you think about that, some of the principals involved in that closing institution, well, they're essentially closed now. Kids are considered too disabled to go to school. Well, nobody's considered disabled to go to school anymore. And we, of course, didn't know the people in Pennsylvania or in Massachusetts, Martha Ziegler and Eleanor Elkin and Tom. We didn't know those people then. We were just going our way, independent of what a lot of other. But we were still a clear minority, right? So you think about things. Rules we sort of adopted. One is we must increase the number of environments in which people with significant disabilities function. That's critical. Two, the environments can't be overloaded. We have to go to a natural distribution. If 1% of you, if your definition of a person with a significant intellectual disability is lowest functioning 1% of the population, then no environment should have more than 1% of the people in it who are significantly disabled intellectually. And then no homogeneous grouping. That's a killer. They're the killers. So now that's sort of how we came about it and involved in it. And we've been sort of involved ever since.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, these are the things that you outlined in the 60s and the late 60s. And there's still the things that are the barriers to students with disabilities in schools.
People are still functioning they're still violating, they're still confining the environments.
Correct.
They're still violating natural distribution and overpopulating certain environments. And they're still homogeneously grouping. Autism is a good example.
Autism is a great example.
So,
I mean, why do you think that if these are the things that we've been working for so long, why has there been so little progress?
Well, let me step back a little bit.
Sure.
First of all, the definition that we sort of adopted, try to live by, is that we're advocates for the lowest intellectually functioning 1% of the population, because these are the people who were excluded from schools before 1942 and 1975. These were the people who were considered too something, too autistic, too physically disabled, too behavior disordered, too something to go to school with everybody else. There were over 300,000 in institutions, and most of them stayed at home, right? They functioned in few environments. They had terribly restricted social lives. The only people that interacted with them were family people, other people with disabilities, and people you give money to, right? So that was the population, and I think that was the original TASH population. And it certainly, there's more to inclusion than the lowest intellectually functioning 1% of the population. But that's the group of people that we were primarily concerned with. Right? Now, what did they have in 1970? Activity centers for some of them, segregated workshops, home. They were stayed at home all day, and we said that's not good enough. That's not good enough. See, when we started to work in Madison schools with kids with significant disabilities, and we followed them. We're still following them to this day, by the way, those who are alive. We followed them. And so now when they finished, what did they do? Well, they went to a segregated workshop, a segregated activity center, or they stayed at home. We said that's not good enough. So we started, and there's a paper, years ago, there's a paper we wrote, publication of CEC, Hey, Don't Forget About Me, it said it was the criterion of ultimate functioning. So if you start with young kids and you stay with them throughout their lives, where does it lead? What do you want? What's the outcome that makes any kind of sense? And so we said that the criteria of ultimate functioning to live, work, and play in integrated society. So anything you do that prepares people with significant intellectual disabilities to live, work, and play in integrated society, you do. Anything you do that interferes with that, you don't do. So that became sort of a guiding rule for us. And of course, that put us smack in conflict with a large percentage of the population and the institutions that serve them. So now, you say, what progress have we made since 1970, 75? Well, now we have schooling for all. You know, thanks. But I think if those parents in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Ed Martin and his group and the federal government and the senators and Congress people who passed the legislation, they're primary. You've got to thank them. When parents and lawyers and Congress people and professionals get together, you can do wonderful things. Now, each year, there are very few people in the country, 320 million, and probably fewer than 25,000 people in institutions, and most of those are nursing homes on institution grounds. We have integrated work. Every year, more and more people with significant disabilities leave school and do real work in the real world. It no longer said it couldn't be done. It used to be if you couldn't do in a sheltered workshop, you sat at home or did nothing. And then and people always came up with reasons why these people couldn't function in integrated society. And they're wrong, right? Now we have university. There were no teacher training programs. As a matter of fact, CEC, they did with people, they had programs to train teachers to work with the mentally retarded, if you will. But these kids were considered sub. They're sub, trainable or to this or to that for those programs. And very few university programs that dealt with kids with severe intellectual disabilities. Right? So now we've increased the environments. It warms my heart to go around to Madison or anywhere and see people with obvious disabilities on a bus, working at a restaurant, in a library, just walking the streets. You couldn't see that when the segregation is to rule the world, right? Now we've got even social relationships have improved.
What is one of the major problems that you see in education?
Okay, when you're talking about the education of kids, there are several, of course. one of the major problems is the learning and performance characteristics of the population we're talking about. I think there's pervasive ignorance of or denial of the learning characteristics of the students we're talking about. For example, they're not that smart. What does that mean? They're going to learn fewer skills in a unit of time, a month, a week, a school year, a career, than everybody, than 99% of the people. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means you have the things you pick to teach them, the skills you teach to teach, you need to teach them, are going to have to be the most important things they need to know. You can't teach them dumb stuff. You can't waste their time. You can't think to teach them something that spend this valuable time teaching them something that by the time they learn it, they're obsolete. Right? The second characteristic of the population is the level of difficulty. I mean, you see some of these IEPs and they're wonderfully exciting and stimulating and, oh boy, they read so beautifully and they've downloaded from all these checklists and, oh, it's great, it's great. The problem is what they're talking about is out of the difficulty range. They're too complicated for the students of concern. They're not intellectually capable of learning them. So now you have to pick an important skill in the difficulty range, the highest part of the difficulty range of an individual student. Another problem. And one of the reasons you say this, that it's significantly disabled intellectually, is that they take longer to learn than everybody else. We refer to it as the number of trials to acquisition. How many trials is it going to take to teach this particular student a very important skill in her difficulty range? Well, let's say you say 100. Well, if you only can get in 50 before you go on to a next skill, she didn't learn anything. So there's no accumulation. and this is a tremendous problem, is over time, is building the repertoire. Now, the next problem that I think is dishonored is practice. If you don't let them, if they don't practice what they know, then they forget, right? So now you have what we call vertical practice, which is classic general education for smart kids. You do addition, then you do subtraction, then you do multiplication, then you do, and you keep going up, making things more complicated. Well, the problem with that vertical development strategy is the our kids, you hit the top of their difficulty range. And then they can count to this, but you start to counting, adding on what they have to count. They don't do it. They can't do it. So what do you do? Well, what you do is you go horizontally. You teach them to use what they know in different activities, in different environments, right? So by doing that, if I teach a skill in school, I make sure they use it in a game, I make sure it's in a functional skill, make sure they use it at home in some way. Then you build in practice and you reduce forgetting. The other major problem that's just it's significantly ignored by educators is the problem of generalization. No one has ever said, you know, the more intellectually disabled you are, the better you generalize. No one ever said that. Everybody knows the more disabled you are intellectually, the more problems you have generalizing, right? So it's senseless to teach somebody a skill in school and then require them to expect them or to hope for them to use that skill someplace else. It just doesn't work. I'm really sorry. So what you have to do is build the generalization into your instructional programs. Get a commitment from parents or friends or anybody so that if I teach them this skill in school, then they're going to use it here and they're going to use it there so they won't forget it and they don't have to worry about deficits in generalization. Another problem that's being ignored is we know overwhelming majority of our students are imitative. They can imitate. The ones that can't, we'll teach them to imitate. We're really good at teaching kids to imitate. Okay, so now we got in school or in our therapy programs, we teach kids to imitate. So now what do we do with them? Well, we put them with other kids who self-stimulate, with other kids who can't talk, with other kids who can't move, you see? So it's crazy to spend your resources teaching imitation skills. We know how to do it, they're imitative, and then you put them with horrible models. So we want to put them with the best possible language, behavior, social, work, whatever models. Well, in schools, where are the best models? They're not in special education settings. They're in the general education setting, right?
We will hear more from our guest Lou Brown later on this season. If you would like to hear the entire unedited interview with Lou Brown, consider becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/thinkinclusivepodcast. Follow the Think Inclusive podcast on the web at thinkinclusive.us. And tell us what you thought of the podcast via Twitter at @inclusive_pod, on Facebook or Instagram. You can also subscribe to the Think Inclusive podcast via Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or on the Anchor app. We'd love to know that you are listening. Also, a reminder that you can support the Think Inclusive podcast either through Patreon, anchor.fm with a monthly contribution, so that we can continue to bring you in-depth interviews with thought leaders in inclusive education and community advocacy. On that note, thanks to Patreons Donna L., Kathleen T., and Renee J. for their continued support of our podcast. Also, a special shout out to my producer and love of my life, Brianna. She will always be number one in my book. And one more shout out to my boys, you know who you are, for all the encouragement. I greatly appreciate it. Next time on the Think Inclusive podcast.
It's a major problem. If you tell me that a child with an intellectual disability in California will spend 80% of their K-12 experience only with other children with disabilities, that's a problem.
Thanks for your time and attention. See you next time.
This has been a production of Think Inclusive LLC. normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.